Hi, Steve Pomerantz here, host of On the Money with today's On the Money Extra, where we feature market updates and insights as well as guest interviews with noted financial experts to help you stay informed and learn the facts to make the right decisions about money. So let's get started. You may have read the work of my next guest. He's Jonathan Clements, former personal finance columnist for the Wall Street Journal, and a steady voice of common sense during those years. He also is the author of the money classic, Jonathan Clements' Money Guide, and I've wanted to interview him for some time, and he's with me today to discuss his new 2016 guide and more. Hi, Jonathan. Welcome to the show.
It's great to be back with you, Steve.
I'm so glad to have you. So, you know, most people who write about money don't talk about themselves and don't relate their own story, you know, and a lot of times it's do what I say, not what I do. And they don't really discuss what goes on in their own unique lives and experiences. But you did it in your 2016 guide entitled, chapters entitled My Story, How I Plan to Handle Retirement. Why don't you start off and tell us about that?
Let me tell you about why I talked about my own finances, Steve. I think, and you probably know this from dealing with clients and dealing with listeners, people are embarrassed about their finances and the mistakes they make, and they have the sense of inadequacy that they're doing all the wrong things. And so I feel that by talking about my own finances and, you know, the things that I do, which are really relatively straightforward, it helps demystify finance and for people to see that, you know, really what we're talking about here are common sense strategies.
Yeah.
Now, it doesn't mean that those common sense strategies are easy to implement. A lot of people struggle to behave in a rational manner when handling their money, but when you get down to it, the strategies involved are really pretty straightforward. So that was my reason behind talking about my own finances. Now, you mentioned specifically about retirement, which is one of the areas I talk about. Mm-hmm. As I mentioned in the book, I currently consider myself to be semi-retired. I don't have a full-time job anymore. Instead, there are a collection of activities that I engage in that, you know, provide enough income to cover my living expenses. I teach a college course. I write freelance articles. I update the Money Guide every year. I have another book in the works. And one of the things that I think about when it comes to retirement is that this sort of part-time work, in my case, a lot of part-time work.
Are you working hard these days or
I'm working harder than I ever have. That's what happens when you work for yourself.
I know. It's true.
The good thing is the commute is really, really short. The bad news is the boss is overbearing and obnoxious.
And every day, and it doesn't leave you alone.
Yep. But this notion of working part-time in retirement is actually, I think, a really powerful notion. If you can go out there and earn even a little bit of money by, you know, working a part-time job. Let's say you can earn $16,000 a year working part-time. One of the common rules of thumb out there among financial planners is that you should use a 4% withdrawal rate on your portfolio. So if you can generate $16,000 a year by working part-time, that's like having $400,000 extra in retirement savings.
Right.
Working part-time can go a long way to not only easing the financial strain of retirement, but also can give retirees a sense of purpose. It gives them a reason to get out of bed in the morning.
Well, it also delays drawing down from your portfolio as well to some degree. I mean, if you can cover all of it, fine, but even a little amount, whether it's 10, 15, 25,000 and more, it will ease the strain, so to speak, on your existing assets, especially in this world where many of us are expected to live a very long time.
Clearly, this is a strategy that, you know, works better for younger retirees than older retirees. I mean, I certainly hope that by the time I'm age 80, if I'm doing any sort of part-time work, it's mostly involving getting up and walking from the bed to my desk. But for younger retirees, it seems perfectly reasonable to me that they work part-time. And indeed, as you know, you suggest, with so many retirees living until age 90 these days, why not work part-time early in retirement? It doesn't seem to me to make any sense to spend the last 25 years of your life sitting around doing nothing. I mean, that's not much of a life. People get a lot of pleasure from working. It really gives them a sense of purpose. It can be very fulfilling.
Speaking with Jonathan Clements, former column writer for the Wall Street Journal, and he wrote probably one of the best, well, or most highly regarded personal finance columns in the country. In your latest guide, you said that you're debating whether to buy an immediate fixed annuity. And for those of you who don't know what that is, it's very simply the fact that you give a lump sum to the insurance company and they guarantee to pay you X dollars per month for the rest of your life or for a certain period of time. It's a very simple, straightforward type of investment. You said you're still debating. What are some of the things that you're debating? What are the characteristics that you're considering?
Well, let's just take one step back, Steve. When I think about generating income in retirement, the top financial priority for most people should be to delay Social Security. I mean, that's the best annuity you're going to get. Social Security, retirement benefits are at least partially tax-free. They're government guaranteed. They're stepped up every year along with inflation, and you'll get them as long as you live. And moreover, if you're the main breadwinner, there's the potential for your benefit to carry on after your death as a survivor benefit for your spouse. So the first annuity you should think about buying is Social Security, and the way you buy the most of it is to delay taking benefits until as late as age 70.
Okay.
So that is the first thing I plan to do. What I'm debating is whether I will supplement that by buying an immediate fixed annuity. And, you know, when you buy an immediate fixed annuity, you know, the downside is it is a firm commitment. You hand over a big chunk of money to an insurance company, and they will cut you a check every month for the rest of your life. You hand over that big chunk of money, and then you go under the next bus, game over.
Mm-hmm.
The amount of money you just gave them is gone. So clearly, you need to think about the state of your health when you buy that immediate fixed annuity. Second, you know, you are assuming that the insurance company is going to continue operating, so you want to make sure that you're buying that immediate fixed annuity from an insurance company that has a top rating for financial strength, and better still, you might actually buy your immediate fixed annuity from multiple insurance companies so that if any one of them gets in trouble, you're not betting everything on one insurance company.
And it's really like a fixed income investment. You would think of it more of as a bond part of your portfolio.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so the alternative is to just hang on to high-quality bonds and spend those down over time.
Yeah.
The difference with the immediate fixed annuity is that, you know, if you live longer than average, you should come out ahead. Essentially, when you buy an immediate fixed annuity, what you're doing is you're throwing your money into a pool together with other retirees. Those who die early in retirement lose out. Those who live longer than average benefit because they get those checks for more years.
Well, yeah, they do, and that is true. Of course, the value of those checks, if they're fixed, you know, I did some simple math, and, you know, if you gave the insurance company $200,000 and you got $12,000, then you're really talking about, especially if you start at age 70, then you'll be age 87 before you've used up your $200,000. So if you live longer than age 87, you're winning the bet. If shorter, you're losing the bet. But unfortunately, that $12,000, because of inflation, is not worth 12 anymore. It's worth about 8.5. So I would say that, you know, I'm sure your advice is before anybody does anything like this, crunch the numbers and get some really good advice on it, because it's a big decision.
It absolutely is. The alternative, of course, is to buy an immediate annuity that pays inflation-linked income. The problem is those tend not to be as competitively priced for this reason. Currently, the only sort of inflation index bonds that an insurance company can go out and buy in order to back up that annuity that they sell are issued by the U.S. government.
Yeah.
By contrast, an insurance company can go out and buy corporate bonds, which will tend to have a somewhat higher yield, to underwrite a plain vanilla immediate fixed annuity. But if they want to do an inflation index annuity, their only choice are these government bonds. So the inflation-linked annuity isn't as competitively priced. Also, you should realize that while Social Security is priced based on the average life expectancy for Americans, so that if you're somebody who's taking care of their health, somebody who has a relatively high income, these are the people who tend to live longer than average. And so delaying Social Security is a good bet. By contrast, insurance companies know that people who buy annuities tend to be wealthier, healthier people. And so the benefit you get by buying the annuity and making that commitment is less than it is when you delay Social Security benefits, because they know they're dealing with a healthier portion of the population.
Right. Well, again, it's a question of working against the house, which is the insurance company, and they're gambling and you're gambling, and they're going to gamble smarter than you are, most likely. Let's change subjects from annuities to your allocation to stocks and bonds. I noticed that you said you're roughly 70% in stocks, 30% in conservative investments, and you suspect you'll shift that to 60-40, let's say, when you hit your mid-60s. Very quickly, what is your main thinking for that?
age 65, I'm potentially looking at a 25-year retirement. If I went more heavily into bonds, you know, referring back to our earlier conversation, I'm making myself extremely vulnerable to inflation.
Yeah.
As a 65-year-old, you know, I may be looking to generate income, generate spending money from my portfolio, but I also need to be concerned about the threat from inflation. And the way to combat that threat from inflation is to continue to have some exposure to stocks.
What about all this terrible volatility we seem to be under?
Well, if I'm age 65 and I'm looking at a 25-year time horizon, you know, I have time enough to ride out big dips in the market. The key here is to structure your portfolio in such a way that when we do get those big dips in the market, you have a pool of cash that you can draw on to pay for your groceries while you're waiting for the market to recover. One of the things that I commonly advise people to do is to keep 5 years of spending money in CDs, in money market funds, savings accounts, and short-term bonds, so when we get that next big market decline, you know you can sit tight with your stocks for 5 years.
5 years is a long time, too. So that would be kind of the worst of the historic periods of time that downturns have occurred. I think generally it's 3 years or so, but you're putting in a little extra margin of safety by going 5 years.
Absolutely. And of course, even if you went through the 5 years, within the sort of longer-term portion of my portfolio, I would still have some bonds so I could start to cash out those bonds. It would take a really severe market decline before I'd have to start selling my stocks.
I noticed that you have more in foreign stocks, not more, but a higher allocation to foreign stocks. And I can tell from your accent that you're originally from England. Do you think you're more comfortable with that because you have more of an international perspective?
That may indeed be the case, Steve. But two other things influence my thinking. I mean, one is, you know, we know from looking back through history that owning foreign stocks is a great way to diversify a U.S. stock portfolio. So holding up to 40% in foreign stocks can substantially reduce the risk of a portfolio that is allocated, you know, mostly to U.S. stocks.
Mm-hmm.
Second, if you look at what's happened over the past 5 years, the U.S. stock market has substantially outperformed foreign markets. And as a consequence, U.S. stocks are much more richly valued than stocks in Europe and the Far East and in emerging markets. So to the extent that valuations are a key driver of future stock performance, you know, if I was a betting man, and I guess to some extent I am, you know, I would bet the foreign stocks will generate superior returns to U.S. stocks over the next decade.
In part of your story, you talked about your adventures in real estate. We don't have a whole lot of time left, but I liked one part here because this is something that I've done the math on, and I speak about quite often. You said since 1992, you've owned three homes, a house in New Jersey in 1992 for $165, and 2 decades later, you sold it for $409. But you said that actually it's not as good as it sounds. Why is that?
I think this is a common experience, but people don't sit down and crunch the numbers and realize what's going on. Yeah. You know, you buy a house for one price and you sell it later for much more and you think you made a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
Once you factor in things like the mortgage interest you had to pay, the property taxes you had to pay, all the money you paid for home improvements and for maintenance, all the money you had to pay for homeowners insurance, what you'll typically find is that after paying all that and paying the closing costs when you bought the house and the real estate commission when you sold, the net result is that you barely break even. And in my case, I was actually underwater. Nonetheless, a home can be a great investment, but not for the reason people think. The reason a home is a great investment is because you get to live there. It's the so-called imputed rent. I figured on my New Jersey house, making a quick back-of-the-envelope calculation, that over the 20 years, that imputed rent was worth about $400,000 to my family.
Mm-hmm.
The imputed rent was far more valuable than any money I made from the price appreciation.
I really believe that that is a tremendous lesson that people need to remember because so many people feel, oh, I need to invest in real estate. I have to invest in real estate because it appreciates. Well, first of all, we all know that real estate doesn't always appreciate. I mean, does anybody remember 2008, 2007? It doesn't always appreciate. Studies that I've seen show it maybe keeps pace with inflation also by owning real estate as it goes up over time. It gives you the ability to stay current if you want to move from one house to another so you can kind of stay current with prices. But more than that, it's not a really a great investment. part of the book coming out, I guess it comes out in January once you get your final numbers, right?
Well, there's an early edition I put out this month in order to get some holiday sales, and that has data through November 30th.
Mm-hmm.
I wrapped up the book on the evening of November 30th, and it was available for sale December 1st, which
okay.
is very cool.
Yeah.
A revised edition will be out January 1st through Amazon, which will be updated as of December 31st. So you know what I'm doing with my New Year's Eve.
I do. So it's the Jonathan Clements Money Guide for 2016?
That's correct, Steve.
All right. Quickly, what are some of the do's and don'ts for 2016?
Well, there are a lot of do's and don'ts for 2016. I mean, you know, in terms of things that people definitely should be doing in 2016, I think something that I would put pretty high up on the list is that people should think about how they'll react if we get a large market decline. I mean, we've had a great run in the U.S. stock market here since 2009 at the market bottom there. Since then, prices have more than tripled. What would it mean to you if the market declined 25 or 30% mm-hmm. from here? This is especially an important question for retirees. You know, we talked earlier about having that cash cushion to carry you through a long market decline. You should run a fire drill. Say, what would it mean for my finances if the market dropped 30%? Would I be okay? If not, this is the time to panic and sell. You should panic and sell when markets are close to their all-time high, not when they're down 30%.
That's probably the best advice I've ever heard. My guest is Jonathan Clements, former personal finance columnist for the Wall Street Journal, also author of the money classic, the Jonathan Clements Money Guide. You can pick it up right now, and you can get the actual 2016 finalized version starting on January 1st, and you can get that at Amazon and other outlets. Jonathan, I'm sorry that we're out of time. I wish we had more time. Maybe we'll do it again real soon. Thank you so much for joining me.
My pleasure, Steve.
And to find out more about Jonathan Clements and to hear this interview again, don't forget to join the conversation at onthemoneyradio.org.
You're listening to On the Money with Certified Financial Planner Steve Pomerantz. If you'd like information about guests, topics, or anything you hear on this program, call 866-MONEY01 or visit the show's website at onthemoneyradio.org.